This is the NBC Sunday Night News, brought to you by Humble Oil and Refining Company and Enco Retailers.
Tonight, Sunday, January 30th, reported by Garrick Utley.
Good evening. If you were a Catholic in Northern Ireland today, this is a date you would not forget. For amid so many days of violence and death, today was one of the worst. If you were Mayor John Lindsay of New York, you would be happy today over some good news in the quest for the Democratic presidential nomination. And if you were an Olympic skier in Sapporo, Japan, you would be waiting nervously today to find out whether you could ski in the Olympics. We'll have reports on all of these tonight, but first in the news, as it is so often, tragically, Northern Ireland. This was a Sunday the people of Northern Ireland will not forget. In Londonderry, at least 13 people, civilians, were killed, shot to death by British soldiers. It all started when Catholics organized a demonstration to protest the continued internment of suspected terrorists. The demonstration, as all demonstrations, was banned by the government.
The marchers numbered between 15 and 20,000. It was a massive display of solidarity expressing the almost total alienation of the people of this part of Derry. The march proceeded quietly enough through the Catholic districts, and armbanded stewards kept the demonstrators from coming into close contact with troops who were manning barricades on the edge of their route. Young bloods at the head of the procession, ignoring the appeals of their stewards, began to pelt police and troops with bricks. After a while, the troops replied. First, the soldiers sprayed the demonstrators with a water cannon, which was followed up with volleys of rubber bullets and CS gas. The demonstrators regrouped and attacked the army barricades again and again. Finally, the troops took the offensive as men of the 1st Battalion, the Parachute Regiment, went roaring into the bogside with armored cars in support to arrest as many rioters as they could lay their hands on. What happened next is obscure. The army say their men were fired on by IRA rooftop snipers. The people of the bogside say the paras fired first, indeed that there was no return fire at all. The body I saw was that of a youth being carried out by other civilians, with a priest in the lead, waving a bloodied handkerchief as a white flag. Meanwhile, more bodies were seen being put into ambulances. From time to time, firing would break out again and the crowd would scatter. And again, a priest was to wave a handkerchief as a white flag while a body was brought forward into a possible line of fire. To the priest.
Tonight, Catholic leaders in Northern Ireland have accused the British of mass murder. The Cardinal Primate of Ireland has demanded an investigation by British Prime Minister Heath, and the Irish Republican Army has sworn to avenge the deaths in Londonderry.
This is the the Grand Isle Tarpon Rodeo off the coast of Louisiana. It's always been one of the best places to sport fish, but oddly enough, the fishing really got good after the oil industry came to these waters. The giant platforms they built attracted marine growth. The growth attracted little fish, which in turn attracted big fish, and so on. ENCO operates 64 of these platforms. We don't take any credit for the good fishing. That's a natural phenomenon. But on the other hand, if the waters weren't good for the fish, there wouldn't be so many little fish, which attract so many big fish, which attract so many fishermen.
Arizona will be the first state to elect a delegation to the Democratic National Convention under the party's new reform program. Yesterday, Arizona Democrats elected delegates to their state convention, and the results held some surprises. It wasn't that Senator Edmund Muskie won 189 delegates and maintained his position as the frontrunner. The surprise was the strong showing of Mayor John Lindsay, who came in second. Senator George McGovern was third. Senators Humphrey and Jackson asked their supporters to vote for uncommitted delegates. Our reporter, Douglas Kiker, has been following developments there.
The election in Arizona was held to choose 500 local delegates who, in turn, will pick the state's 25 delegates to the National Democratic Convention. It represents an effort by Arizona Democrats to comply with the party's new reform rules for delegate selection. But the way they went about it was, to say the least, unique and confusing. Depending on the size of his district and the number of delegates to be elected there, a voter could cast, all by himself, anywhere from 12 to 26 votes. And what's more, he could cast them any way he liked, all for one candidate or divided among several different candidates.
Hello, my name's Sandy Macedo, and I'm running committed to Senator Muskie, and I would appreciate your vote very much.
Over 1,600 candidates ran for the 500 delegate seats. And Democratic presidential candidates employed varied strategies to deal with the unique method of voting that was used. Senator Edmund Muskie ran a full slate of 500 delegates and a big, well-coordinated statewide campaign. John Lindsay focused his attention on young voters and minority groups. Lindsay also spent a lot of money on advertising, and he entered a smaller slate of delegates in an effort to concentrate his support and make every vote count. Organized labor in Arizona, looking toward the possibility of a deadlocked Miami convention, was out to elect uncommitted delegates. So union workers combed through membership files and manned banks of phones in an attempt to get their vote out.
Hi.
Hi. McGovern Slate, hope you all voted, and here's some material that you might like to look at as you go through the line.
To deal with the anticipated confusion, supporters of all the candidates stood outside the polling stations handing out voting lists, and election officials were on hand to explain the voting procedure to those who still didn't understand.
These are the delegates. These are the candidates that they're standing for. And you have 17 votes. Do you want to give all 17 to one delegate?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, then you decide who.
But most people seemed to know who they wanted to vote for and how to go about it. Party leaders had predicted that only about 13,000 voters, that is 5% of the registered Democrats, would turn out for this election. But they were wrong. Over twice that many participated, including a sizable force of young voters. The system of reform delegate selection Arizona used was complex, but somehow it worked. 4 years ago, a handful of political leaders hand-picked the state's Democratic delegation. And this time, thousands of people are having a voice in the matter. What they said in this delegate election has national implications. The big winners in Arizona were Edmund Muskie and John Lindsay. The big losers were George McGovern and organized labor. Labor's attempt to elect uncommitted delegates backfired. McGovern ran an ambitious, well-organized campaign and ended up coming in third. Muskie took a big chance by entering such a large slate of delegates because his vote could have been diluted, but it paid off in a convincing display of populist support. And Lindsay came in second, which is the first demonstration of the considerable voter appeal he's always claimed to have. Douglas Kiker, NBC News, Phoenix.
The Black Caucus, which is made up of leaders of American Black Society, announced today that it will hold a national political convention in Gary, Indiana from March 12th to the 14th. and added, according to a spokesman of the caucus, the convention will draw up a platform of demands which will then be given to the leaders of the Democratic and Republican parties. Here's the latest on the continuing Howard Hughes autobiography mystery. Time magazine reports tonight that Clifford Irving, who wrote the book, might have gotten his information from a secret computer printout prepared for use by Hughes and containing everything ever written by or about the billionaire. Irving remained in seclusion today, reportedly consulting with his lawyer.
There isn't another place in the world like Avery Island, Louisiana. At least not to the thousands of tourists who visit here every year. The McElhenney family created it as a sanctuary for endangered species of birds, for exotic shrubs and plants, and for fields of red peppers grown for the island's famed Tabasco sauce. But Avery Island also has something which might seem alien to all this, something that tourists rarely see, an oil field. Nearly 100 wells like this one, operated by Humble Oil and Refining Company. It's not typical of all our oil fields, but it's an example of how industry and nature can coexist side by side without ruffling each other's feathers.
The Winter Olympics open this week in Sapporo, Japan. There will be the usual gathering of graceful figure skaters, brawny hockey players, and flamboyant skiers. All of them will be amateurs, or at least they're supposed to be amateurs. The trouble is that it's becoming increasingly difficult to distinguish between amateurs and professionals, and this is especially true of skiers.
On the weekend before the Winter Olympics, the city of Sapporo staged a winter festival with incredible ice sculptures in a park. This was a prelude to the Olympics. But unfortunately, the real prelude was being held in hotel rooms as a controversy brewed that threatened to rip the games apart.
First, this is what it's about. For years, skiers, particularly European skiers, have been flagrantly advertising. They have contracts with ski companies, and whenever there are pictures to be taken, the names of their skis are quite prominent. And when they ski, other companies buy space on their bibs, like Evian, the bottled water company. All of this commercialism is quite against the rules of the Olympics, and the president of the Olympic Committee, Avery Brundage, says skiers who do it should be disqualified. Brundage came to Sapporo adamant.
The Olympic Games are not a business enterprise. They're a sport event. They're designed for those who are interested in sport for sport's sake. And those who are interested in sport as an adjunct to a tourist department or a manufacturing concern do not belong in the Olympic Games.
The head of the Austrian ski team says if any of his men is disqualified by the Olympics, all of his team will pull out.
I think we have to find a new way for qualification to Olympic Games, because if you have the same qualification rules as they are now, I don't think the main aim of Olympic Games, to give the highest performance in sport, can be fulfilled.
So, the skiers say in order to train, they cannot have jobs, and without jobs, they have to get money somehow, so they must commercialize. And Avery Brundage, the millionaire president of the Olympics, says if skiers sell themselves, they are not amateurs, pure and true, and the Olympics does not want them. But in fact, without them, if they are disqualified and removed from these games, alpine skiing at these Olympics will be contests of assured mediocrity. Jack Perkins, NBC News, Sapporo.
These Olympic Games haven't even started, but already the 1976 Winter Olympics are generating their own controversy. They're supposed to be held in Colorado, just outside of Denver. But many people there, including some who worked actively to get the Olympic Games, don't want them. They've sent a delegation to Sapporo, where Olympic officials will make a final decision on the 1976 site tomorrow.
This is the site of the 1976 Winter Olympics. Those Winter Olympics are in for some tough sledding, also some tough skiing, because as you can plainly see, there is almost no snow. There is very rarely ever much snow at the site, in the foothills above Denver. And yet, in a fit of civic boosterism, a group of business leaders 2 years ago convinced the International Olympics Committee this would be the perfect spot for the 76 Games. The Lieutenant Governor of Colorado later admitted the organizers had lied a bit in making their presentation. The boosters wanted the Olympics to promote the state.
I think the economic benefit is difficult to assess, but one of our great industries is tourism, and I think it is appropriate to acknowledge the fact that we hope to enhance the reputation of Colorado as a ski area and an area of outstanding beauty of the United States. And I think the long-term financial benefits are difficult to put a figure on them, but I think they'll be substantial.
Now, many people who originally supported the Olympics, like State Representative Richard Lamb, are against holding the games in the state.
We live in a state that has, you know, historically felt that it was a good idea to become bigger. Every state, every little town up until 4 or 5 years ago had these little signs out, you know, Junction City 2000, watch us grow. Well, all of a sudden, citizens in Colorado are saying, we're not sure that we want that vision of the future. We look to California and see what progress has done to California, and we're not so sure that we don't silently dissent.
Opponents have started a petition campaign against the Olympics. It is admittedly belated, and it has only a small chance of success. But it apparently touched a sensitive spot, because in 3 weeks' time, more than 20,000 people signed the petition. Enough money was collected to send these three people to Sapporo for a lobbying effort against the Olympics. They'll try to convince the International Olympics Committee to move the games, possibly to some place which has had them before.
We are asking that the IOC in future recycle events in existing sites. The system of holding events in a new location each time has made of the Olympics a real estate promotion. This is what it is in Colorado.
Since the Olympics can scarcely be held on the snowless slopes above Denver, the committee must now turn to one of the established resorts, like Aspen or Vail or Steamboat Springs. And that is certain to mean a real estate bonanza in whichever resort is chosen. Here in Aspen, the town council officially favors the Olympics. Many of the residents say the games would only bring their town more publicity, more growth, and more problems. Even using an established resort like Aspen, the Olympics will cost an estimated $25 million, and possibly much more. Many people wonder whether the state can afford to spend that kind of money on what is essentially self-promotion.
In a sense, the people of Colorado are having to live with a decision made in the mid-60s, when boosting your state was still considered to be good for business. Now many people in the state have decided they don't believe that anymore. But they've got the Winter Olympics anyway, and there's not much they can do about it. John Dansley, NBC News, in Aspen, Colorado.
America's demand for oil is soaring, and the supply under our lands is dwindling. That is why we must look under the sea for new reserves. It's a big job, and an expensive one. For example, this is a model of what will be the world's tallest drilling platform. Engineers at Humble Oil are using it to determine how such a huge structure can be safely transported and installed. When the actual platform is built, it will be towed to a drilling site and upended by flooding compartments in the legs. Once in place, it will rise 800 feet, almost as high as the Eiffel Tower. It's an ambitious project, but in view of our need for more energy, a necessary one.
President President Zulfikar Ali Bhutto of Pakistan has decided to withdraw his country from the British Commonwealth effective immediately. The reason, according to the announcement, is that Great Britain, New Zealand, and Australia are about to recognize Bangladesh, the former East Pakistan. The Commonwealth is made up of Britain's former colonies. And there has been more violence in Bangladesh. Clashes broke out today in the suburbs of Dhaka between Bengalis and members of the Bihari community. They are the people who sided with the Pakistani army during the civil war there. Since the war, the Biharis have been living in ghettos protected from the angry Bengalis by the Indian army. But the Indian Guard was withdrawn over the weekend. The violence erupted, and according to a United Nations source, at least 16 people were killed and more than 50 were injured. American military sources in Saigon reported today that large-scale troop movements of North Vietnamese soldiers are occurring. They said thousands of the enemy soldiers are moving down through the demilitarized zone and through southern Laos towards the northern and western borders of South Vietnam, perhaps preparing for a new offensive. But another American military source in Saigon described these enemy movements along the borders as just normal seasonal activity. Defense Secretary Melvin Laird said today there will be no draft calls for February or March. Laird also said the United States would not send American troops back to Vietnam in case of a new unforeseen emergency there. Those are today's stories. Now let's take a look at some of the important developments we can expect in the week ahead.
Phase two of the West Coast dock strike begins its third week tomorrow, and in San Francisco, there'll be another effort at negotiation between shippers and longshoremen. In San Jose, California, there'll be pretrial motions in the Angela Davis case. On Tuesday, California's Governor Ronald Reagan appears before a congressional committee investigating welfare reform. He's against the president's welfare reform program. On Wednesday, three captains of the Russians' herring fleet must appear again in court in Alaska. They claim they're innocent of violating U.S. territorial waters.
Nixon administration officials go before the Senate Appropriations Committee this week for hearings on the new budget. Because of the $38 billion deficit in the previous budget, Treasury Secretary Conley will ask the House Ways and Means Committee to raise the legal ceiling on the national debt. Labor Secretary Hodson will appeal again to Congress, this time to the House Labor Subcommittee, to pass emergency legislation to end the West Coast dock strike. And on Wednesday, the annual National Draft Lottery will be held.
In Europe this week, the United States resumes trade negotiations with a common market. America wants a better break on tobacco, grains, and fruit sold to Europe. Here in Britain, with unemployment at the 1 million mark, the jobless will begin a month of protest marches. Eventually, they will converge on London. In Rome on Thursday, another general strike is expected, with three big unions demanding action against rising unemployment. In Ethiopia, the United Nations Security Council on Friday winds up its hearings on the problems of Africa.
In China this week, a team of American technicians will start assembling a satellite ground station, enabling pictures of President Nixon's arrival there and his other activities to be seen live on television stations around the world. In Vietnam, security precautions are being increased in anticipation of a possible communist offensive timed to coincide with the Tet holiday, February 15th. And in Sapporo, Japan, the 11th Winter Olympic Games open Thursday in the presence of Emperor Hirohito.
If you pull into an ENCO station and the service seems to be a little overeager, it might be that you've pulled into a dealer training school run by Humble Oil and Refining Company. The schools are scattered across the country and they look like any other well-run station. The only difference is they're set up to train future ENCO dealers to go out later and run their own stations. The course lasts 6 weeks. It includes classroom instruction on engines, brake systems, tires, cooling systems, and other technical things. And it requires every prospective dealer to go out and do all the things that should be done to serve his customers better. Of course, you won't meet five training school graduates every time you pull into an ENCO station, but there's a good chance you'll meet at least one.
Crop Crime is often a highly specialized field. There are thieves who specialize in diamonds, others who are connoisseurs and steal only very valuable paintings. And then there are the archaeological thieves. They plunder the ruins of ancient civilizations, and they've existed throughout history. But lately, archaeological robbery has been growing in size and organization, most of it in Central America, especially Mexico.
Modern Mexico is a marriage of Indian and Spanish cultures. Mexicans are proud of the richness and diversity of both their pre-Columbian and colonial art. But look closely at this old Spanish church. The niches on both sides of the doorway are empty. The statues which once stood there have disappeared. This scene is repeated at colonial churches all over Mexico, and their interiors are worse. This is the work of art thieves, called saqueadores, or pillagers. Religious art has enjoyed a growing vogue over the past 15 years. The prices keep going up. Art thieves sell generally through middlemen to antique shops like this one, or to private collectors. Some stolen Mexican art has turned up in foreign museums. Millions of dollars worth fraudulently leave Mexico every year. The canyon where these women were washing clothes is typical. Thousands of natural caves line the canyon's walls. They were used before Columbus by the highly civilized Indians as tombs. The caves have been completely sacked of relics and art objects, presumably for sale by peasants of the region. This temple facade is the most important known case of art theft in Mexico. The pillagers, an internationally financed group of highly skilled professionals, went deep into the jungle of southeast Mexico, armed with electric saws, a generator, and a light plane. They cut the temple face into small pieces and smuggled them into the United States, where they were reassembled. The plan failed because the Metropolitan Museum of Art of New York, to which the temple was offered for purchase, turned it back to Mexico. These are more objects, recuperated in 4 months of intense effort designed to stem the illicit trade in antiquities. They are soon to be shown in exhibition and have a total value of around $10 million, an indication of the dimensions of the art theft. So far in the present campaign, 14 persons have been jailed, with sentences up to 12 years, for unauthorized excavations and illegal export of antiquities. But the whole business seems rather like that other illegal Mexican trade, the export of marijuana. The profits to be made are so great, the area to be controlled so vast, that authorities seem to face virtually an impossible job. Tom Streithorst, NBC News, Mexico City.
Good night for NBC News.
This has been the NBC Sunday Night News, brought to you by Humble Oil and Refining Company and Enco Retailers.